Okay, well, good evening, everybody, and thank you very much for coming to the London School of Economics and Political Science. My name is Tim Forsyth. I'm a lecturer in the Development Studies Institute. And I'm delighted to introduce tonight's meeting, which is about civil society and climate change. And I'd like to point out that tonight's meeting is part of various meetings associated with the Center for the Global Civil Society at the LSE, which is the organization which produces this book, for example, this annual yearbook of civil society, full of interesting detailed information from various authors about various aspects of politics around the world. This evening we're going to be talking about climate change and the role of activists and organizations in representing the diverse people affected by climate change. And we have three absolutely first-rate speakers, first-rate in the sense that they know their stuff and are influential, but also first-rate in the sense that they're all very good speakers, and they're all wonderful people. I know them all. Our first speaker is Salim Hook from the International Institute of Environment and Development, which is one of the more meatier NGOs and think tanks involved with environment and development issues. Salim is the director of a climate change program, and he'll be speaking first. Second is Andrew Sims. Andrew is the director of policy at the New Economics Foundation and is also an alumnus of the LSE himself and is always cropping up on TV, radio, and is coming out with a new book, Ecological Debt. I recommend you to look at it. And thirdly, we have Peter Newell, who is a senior research fellow at the Center for the Study of Globalization and Regionalization at the University of Warwick, who is also an ex-colleague of mine, and is another excellent fellow. We did have a fourth person down, Mark Kemba. Some of you may have noted his name. He unfortunately cannot make it, but that is actually okay because it allows our existing speakers to say a bit more. So I'm asking each speaker to speak for about 10 or 15 minutes each, and then we shall have a discussion at the end. We shall have to end at 8 o'clock. So I'd like to ask Salim to start the debate. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tim, and thanks to the organizers for inviting me. Let me just start by describing a little bit more about my own particular interest in the climate change issue. I work for the International Institute for Environment and Development here in London, which has been working for the last 30 years on issues of environment and development. And I run the climate change program. So the climate change program at IIED is very much looking at the interface between the issue of climate change and development, particularly from the developing countries' perspective. And what I propose to do in the next few minutes is to tell you a little bit about the history of the climate change debate, particularly from the science and the international negotiations, and then where we are now, and again, particularly from the perspective of a group of countries that I work with most closely, which is the poorest countries, which are called the least developed countries, which are nearly 50 of the poorest countries, mostly sub-Saharan Africa, which is a recognized UN group within the broader developing country umbrella of the G77 in China. So starting with the history of the climate change debate, as I'm sure everybody here is familiar, it started off from the scientific community bringing it to the attention of the political community in the late 80s, early 90s through the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was set up under the joint aegis of two UN bodies, namely the United Nations Environment Program and the World Meteorological Organization. And essentially what they did in their first assessment report, which came out in 1990, was to bring to the attention of the world the fact that the greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere have been rising since the Industrial Revolution due to the burning of fossil fuels like coal, oil, and gas. And at the rate that they were going ahead, based on computer models of the global atmosphere, they would go to such an extent in the next 50 to 100 years as to cause very severe global warming in an unprecedented manner. So it was very much based on the last 150 years' worth of empirical observations of the rise in atmospheric carbon dioxide as well as other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and the projections into the future of what is likely to happen. It was sufficiently alarming for the world's leaders to get together and to devise a global treaty, given that it was a global problem that no single country could solve on its own and required international cooperation. And we then had in 1992 at the Rio Earth Summit the signing of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which was signed by all countries and ratified by them, including the United States of America, which recognizes that this is a problem, it's a global problem, and that it needs global solutions, or all countries need to be involved in tackling it. It also recognized in the Framework Convention that the primary responsibility for the emissions that have occurred already belong to what are called the developed countries, and they're actually listed in the Framework Convention at the back of the convention in an annex called Annex 1, and are referred to in the climate change terminology as Annex 1 countries, which are basically the list of developed countries. And it recognizes that these countries have a primary responsibility for taking first action to combat this problem. Subsequently, we then had a few more years, and the second assessment report came out a few years later in 1995 of the IPCC, which said that they were now seeing that the concentrations of emissions, concentrations of GHGs or greenhouse gas in the atmosphere were going up and rather than decreasing, and that unless strong action was taken to reduce the emissions, it wasn't going to happen. And basically, this was recognized as being a flaw in the original Framework Convention, which was based on voluntary action. Everybody agreed that action needs to be taken, but nobody was committed to acting first, or nobody was given, no country was given specific targets to meet, and they continued to emit emissions, greenhouse gases, and the concentration rose. As a result, subsequently in 1997 in Kyoto, at the third conference of parties of the convention has an annual gathering of all the parties that are signed up to it, and at the third such session in Kyoto, Japan in 1997, they did agree on targets for each of the Annex I countries. Each country negotiated a particular target for them to meet to reduce their emissions over a period of time, and that came to be known as the Kyoto Protocol. It was an amendment to the original Framework Convention. The United States at that time negotiated a target for itself. It was under the Clinton administration. There was a lot of bargaining. They did agree to it. They signed it, but they, as you all are aware, later on after a change in administration in the U.S., the Bush administration withdrew its signature from the Kyoto Protocol and said they weren't going to participate, and so did Australia. Subsequently, we had the third assessment report of the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change came out a few years later, another 5 or 6 years later in 2001, saying that we can now actually see possible impacts of climate change, and we can predict that in the near term, in the next 10 or 20 years, we are not going to be able to prevent the climate change from occurring because of the lag period involved. If you emit carbon dioxide today, it's not going to warm the atmosphere for quite a few years. So what we've emitted today is locked into the atmosphere for the next 10 or 20 years. And what we are seeing today is not emissions, not caused by emissions of today or yesterday. They're caused by emissions of last 10 years. And the lag effect is such that we are going to inevitably going to have to deal with the impacts of climate change in the near term, which means in the next 10 or 20 years. The result of that was at the seventh conference of parties in Marrakesh in Morocco, the agreement under what are called the Marrakesh Accords to set up a number of funds to deal with the impacts of climate change, which in the climate change jargon are called adaptation to climate change. So you have two response strategies to the climate change problem. The first one is called mitigation, which is to reduce the emissions to prevent potential harm and potential impacts in the future. And the second one, adaptation, is to deal with actual impacts that are likely to occur and to reduce and minimize them, but not necessarily to reduce them to zero, but at least minimize them to the extent possible. These new funds, adaptation funds, were set up in Marrakesh, and they started activities to identify the kinds of activities and adaptations that particularly the poorer countries could do. At that point in time, a group of poor and vulnerable countries, namely the least developed countries, which, as you can see from the name, are the poorest countries in the world, most of them sub-Saharan Africa, but there are a number of them in Asia, including Bangladesh, which is where I come from originally, are part of this group. There are 49 of them in the UN. they negotiated a particular fund for them called the LDC Fund, or the Least Developed Countries Fund, to support them to carry out activities to deal with the impacts of climate change. We now, as we all know, are in the process of developing, the IPCC is in the process of developing its fourth assessment, which is due out in a year's time from now. It'll be out next year. And the expectation is that one of the outcomes of that will be that the scientific community will tell us that they can actually see climate change happening. It's not something that's going to happen in the future. It's not something that we need to worry about in the far distant future, although what we can prevent is catastrophic climate change for the whole globe. What we have failed to prevent is dangerous climate change for part of the globe. For some ecosystems and for some communities and some countries, they are going to have to deal with human-induced climate change, whether we like it or not. And we could stop emitting GHGs today, and this would not stop the climate change for the next 10, 20 years. It's locked into the atmosphere, it's locked into the physical system, and it will happen. Therefore, we're going to have to help these countries, particularly the poor countries, that don't have the capacity to deal with climatic impacts of today, let alone the potential much more lethal and much more negatively impacting impacts of the future. So in the international negotiations, as we've just concluded a couple of months ago in Montreal in Canada, which was the 11th conference of parties of the convention, and also the first meeting of parties of the Kyoto Protocol, as the Kyoto Protocol finally came into force last year. It was the first meeting of the Kyoto parties, was able to do two things. Firstly, to be able to agree on further cuts for the future, or discussions about how to do those in the future. There's a lot of suspicion or apprehension that they wouldn't be able to achieve that, particularly given the United States pulling out of Kyoto and doing its best to prevent the Kyoto countries from going ahead. They weren't able to prevent that. Kyoto countries did agree to go ahead and talk about future cuts. But also on the adaptation side, the recognition that climate change is something that we're going to have to deal with. All countries, all people in all countries are going to have some impacts and are going to have to deal with it. Rich countries probably have the wherewithal to prevent the worst impacts, but they're not going to escape. And as we saw in Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, even the richest country in the world could not prevent its citizens from being affected. Particularly the poorer and more vulnerable citizens in all countries, even in rich countries, are the ones that are going to be affected. And the poor countries as a whole, particularly the least developed countries in Africa, Asia, and in Latin America, are those that are going to be most badly affected. So far in the negotiations, their voices haven't been very strongly heard. One of the things that we've been trying to do is to get the LDC countries, particularly, to improve their negotiating skills, to be able to work together as a group. One of the biggest problems they have in the international negotiations is generally they can only afford to send one or two delegates to the international negotiations, which are extremely complicated. They run in parallel streams of 10 or 12 different streams, and it's impossible for small delegations to really follow them properly. But together, as I said, with 49 countries, they do have a large number of people if they were to be able to use their strength in numbers as a group and negotiate as a group. And one of the things that they've been able to do over the last few years, they took some time getting their act together, but in the last couple of years they have been a bit more vocal and fighting for their cause, and other civil society groups, NGOs, have been helping them in that process, including our own. Maybe I'll stop there, and then if people have questions and want to know more about it, we can talk about it later.
Thanks, Salim. Well, maybe we will come back later and ask you more about your own views about the more recent debates about policies which have been proposed, and also some of the information which has been put out recently about the catastrophic change likely. Okay, well, before we move on to that, now let's move on to Andrew Sims.
Hi. Well, I was hoping that Salim would keep talking for at least another 10 minutes so that I could get to the bottom of this question. There's something about stepping into the LSE which immediately sets the alarm bells ringing when you have these slightly obtuse questions. And it feels like there's a trick to it somewhere. It feels like someone's going to jump on you towards the end of the session and say, aha, you colonialist, imperialist oppressor, how dare you speak on behalf of people you're not allowed to speak on behalf of. So I was hoping Salim would chat for a little longer to see if I could work out whether indeed there was a trick question involved in the title of this evening's session. And I'm, I'm still not terribly sure, but I'm glad that Salim spoke first, because of all the people I know who are working, and I thought it'd be something really technical about voice and agency and discourse theory and all the rest of it, but of all the people I know working in the area, Salim and IIED have identified in the field of climate change what has been one of the critical weaknesses which you see at almost every single international negotiation at the top table, whether it's to do with the World Bank or the IMF or the WTO. And that's the question of capacity among developing countries to bring their negotiators to the table, and also to do it in such a way that they're not outnumbered by... I mean, what's completely ironic in terms of who is speaking for whom, just to kind of throw it into stark relief. For at least the last 2 years, and probably for a lot longer than that, the largest single delegation at every conference of the parties, the annual climate change negotiations, has been the United States, regardless of the fact that they haven't even signed the protocol. So you sit there and ask yourself, what are these guys really doing here if it's not to suck the breath out of all the other negotiators there who are trying to create some movement? But what Salim and IIED have been doing have been specifically trying to build the capacity and help train people from southern civil society, but also from government delegations, to take a fuller part in the negotiations so that there are a plurality of voices and that developing countries are being properly represented. In terms of who is speaking for whom, another thing I tend to find is that wherever you are, and whichever debate you're involved in, it always seems to be sort of our friends from the business community who are speaking on behalf of absolutely everybody else and defining the terms of the debate. If any of you are listening to the Today programme this morning, there was one of those marvellously named trade associations on representing the UK energy intensive industries. I mean, who'd even come up with a name for a trade association like that? To put a little 666 above your office door, and it was great because they were talking about the split in the government at the moment between, there's another interesting question about who is speaking for whom, between the DTI and DEFRA, and the fact that the government had been forced to publish two figures for potential carbon cuts from the UK by the year 2010, and it all revolved around the question of whether the UK is going to meet its self-imposed 20% cut on 1990 levels by 2010. And this guy from the UK Energy Intensive Industries Association came out and was saying that the higher figure, the 8 million tonne cut figure, was unrealistic. And you thought, well, unrealistic for whom and unrealistic for why? And what was he implying would be realistic, that we'd be allowed to pursue a path of greenhouse gas emissions which might push us towards tipping over an irreversible climate change event? And so in terms of who has control of the language, that's another fundamental and interesting question. And it's interesting to look, to reflect over the way that the climate change debate has emerged over the last decade plus. And when I say decade plus, I really mean plus, because it's often overlooked when people raise questions about the certainty with which we can address whether or not climate change is happening, that there was some disturbingly accurate predictions made by the Swedish chemist Svante Arrhenius in the 19th century, first published to the Swedish Physical Society in about 1896. And he, if you look at the way that he calculated it, he actually came about it almost by accident, but he predicted almost precisely what the implication of the growing concentration of greenhouse gases would be over a certain range for global temperature range. And so that's been with us for over 100 years. So in terms of who is speaking for whom, there's been a body of knowledge within a discourse which is extremely technocratic and scientific for a very long time. And in many ways, I think that's acted as a block to civil society, broadly defined, taking ownership and gaining control and getting a handle on the climate change debate. And again, answering the, or looking at the question of who is speaking for whom, the government's chief scientific advisor has become very active recently, David King, or Sir David King, I think it is now. And he's very happy to throw around not just his sort of scientific opinion, and to his credit, he is now quite convinced that climate change is a reality, but to, shall we say, stretch his brief ever so slightly and give us indications of what he thinks is and is not realistic, economically and politically speaking, in terms of the sorts of ceilings we might be able to reach for climate change. And that's interesting, because scientific advice, which is what the IPCC has been set up for and what David King is supposed to provide to our own government's negotiating and decision-making procedure, is supposed to give us a picture of what are dangerous thresholds, etc., etc. And to put his comments into context, I think it's fair to say that there's a growing body, a rising consensus that temperature rise much above 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels represents a level at which we will start to see potentially irreversible environmental feedbacks from climate change. David King, as the chief scientific advisor to the government, has felt able to say that he thinks it's unrealistic that we could, and I should say that 2 degrees figure is thought to be commensurate with about 450 parts per million CO2 equivalent concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, 450. That's the key number to remember. David King has said he thinks it's simply unrealistic that we could hold ourselves at much below 550. So there's an interesting question there about people sticking to their briefs and who's allowed to say what. If you look at the kind of voices coming out of the world of orthodox economics, which is a very broad and brushed, sweeping term, for whom the Danish statistician Bjørn Lomborg has made himself a chief spokesperson, has taken the role of chief spokesperson, they ran a few numbers and came to the conclusion that it would simply be too expensive to act to prevent runaway, irreversible, catastrophic climate change, so perhaps we shouldn't do it. We should spend our money on other things instead, which is another interesting way in which people can engineer themselves into a position of influence in which they're speaking on behalf of, or engineer themselves to be in a position to speak on behalf of, great other swathes of opinion. Because what is climate change? Is it a scientific issue? Is it a political issue? Is it an economic issue? Or is it a justice and an equity issue? Because if you spoke to a group of people, for example, from the South Pacific island of Tuvalu, who have very little voice in the international proceedings. Actually, a little bizarre anecdote here. Tuvalu is, I think, a very fascinating case study because it seems to be enjoying, wrong word, experiencing a great paradox of the 21st century in that it won the lottery of the internet age by being given the internet domain name of .tv, which, for obvious and understandable reasons, a lot of people want to use. So Tuvalu have a larger delegation in Hollywood selling rights to .tv than they do at the United Nations negotiating on behalf of their economic and political future. But of course, what's even more deeply ironic than that the highest point of land in Tuvalu is no more than about 3 or 4 meters above sea level. So just at the point that they're cashing in on selling their virtual domain, they are in serious danger of losing their real one. But if you talk to people in Tuvalu, they've got an awful lot to say about this issue, even though they find it very difficult to find a platform and a voice to talk about it, because they tried in a very polite way to negotiate an agreement with Australia that would enable them to have a balanced, managed, progressive relocation of population over a number of decades. And Australia, with its uniquely badly, extraordinarily named immigration policy, which they refer to as the Pacific Solution, I don't know who came up with that, told Tuvalu where to go, and it wasn't to Australia, and had the audacity at the same time to turn round to Tuvalu in an attempt to find places to park people who wanted to, refugees who wanted to go to Australia to build a new life, actually had the audacity to ask Tuvalu if it would take its own unwanted refugees. So there's not a huge civil society in Tuvalu because it only has a population of about 10,000 people. in fact, nearly everybody there, apart from people working as merchant seamen, or bizarrely producing stamps, which is their major export for British stamp collectors. They have a very low voice, but a major stake, because they could well be one of the first countries to cease to exist as a consequence of climate change. And one of the biggest problems in terms of gaining access, and how long have I been chatting away for now? I've completely
lost another 5 minutes.
Again, another 5 minutes. Another interesting example which throws some of these issues into stark relief, because it also throws into stark relief some of the extremely difficult development choices that many developing countries face, comes from Salim's backyard in Bangladesh. In April last year, on the London Stock Exchange, a company listed called Asia Energy. And on the first day of listing, it raised about £12 million to fund itself. It came into existence purely off the back of winning a single concession to mine coal in Bangladesh, the Pulbury coal fields. And it won a concession which will last for 30 to 40 years, during which time it will mine about somewhere in the region of 300 million tonnes of coal plus. One of the reasons why, economically speaking, regardless of the fact that exactly how much Bangladesh as a country will benefit economically from the coal mined is widely open to question, but one of the reasons why a country like Bangladesh feels the need to go down that route is because in so many other ways in the global economy, which it also has very little political leverage, is that the textile industry in Bangladesh could very well be effectively put out of business overnight by China entering, through its membership of the WTO, the global market. So it falls back on liquidating some of its natural assets. But of course, I probably don't need to spell out the paradox of so much coal going up in smoke in a country like Bangladesh, which has one of the largest sort of areas susceptible to flooding and extreme weather events. So just that they might be closing the till on exploiting the Pulbury coal fields, as the environment minister from Bangladesh said a little while ago, they may well be looking for homes for 20 million environmental refugees or so. And environmental refugees may well be one of the clearest and most visible examples or sort of symptoms of climate change that we see over the coming decades. The Norman Myers at Oxford University has estimated that we could have as many as 150 million by the middle of this century. And to put that into context, in the early 90s, at the height of the political upheavals in the Balkans around the world, we had maybe 26, 27 million political refugees. So the number of environmental refugees will be huge. Now, environmental refugees, a fact but not one recognised by international law, or at least not explicitly, because there is no agreed way or plan or explicit rights that someone who becomes a refugee through environmental push factors, in spite of the whys and wherefores of how climate change has come about and who's overwhelmingly responsible for it, there's nothing in order to apportion the burdens of responsibility in the international system for that. No organisations explicitly working towards it. I'll just sort of round off maybe with a little example of the confusion of voices and who is speaking for whom in this issue. Looking back to the summer of last year, before I say that, I will just mention that in an attempt to give much broader and more diverse ownership amongst civil society on the climate change issues, Salim and I have worked together to set up a coalition of the major environment and development agencies who, in spite of the fact that in 1992 we had something called the UN Conference on Environment and Development, I think it's probably fair to say that those two constituencies, the huge civil society constituencies, the environment and development groups, if anything, grew further apart in the decade after the Earth Summit than that they were in 1992, and that's been a real problem. In an attempt to deal with that, we set up a thing called the Working Group on Climate Change and Development, or as it's become known after the name of two of the reports it's put out, the Up in Smoke Group, and we're using that to try and have a clearinghouse of information to give wider ownership. But I'll just sort of round off to see what a kind of bizarre world it is, that in the G8 summit last year, the British government put both Africa and climate change at the top of their agenda to discuss with the G8 heads of state. Tony Blair has staked a lot of his political credibility on what he's done for Africa, as indeed has Gordon Brown, and Tony Blair has made an awful lot of political capital about showing, in inverted commas, I'll use them just once this evening, showing international leadership on the climate change issue. So you would think, wouldn't you? You would imagine that between the two of them and their massed ranks of special advisers, that with the whole world coming, all the heads of state, the most powerful self-appointed heads of state, world leaders, coming to Britain, to Scotland, to talk about Africa and climate change, that they wouldn't overlook the fact that Britain hadn't paid a penny into the pots of money set up specifically to help Africa adapt to climate change. But they did. And as if that wasn't confusing and foolish enough, we then had Bob Geldof putting his head on Tony Blair's shoulder, telling us all it was okay, that everything was going to be fine. And a lot of rather disillusioned and rather upset and rather confused NGOs walking away, thinking he'd been their best friend, shaking their heads in disbelief. So I'm still not sure if I can answer the question succinctly, but I hope that was a useful reflection on some of its bits. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much, Andrew. That's sparking a lot of thoughts among certain people, and maybe we can hear more about Bob Geldof later on.
We must
hear from Peter Newell, who also does a bit of rock music himself, but you'll have to ask him about that in another time. But Peter will now round up the discussion. Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Since I'm the token academic on this panel, and also the author of the chapter in the Global Civil Society volume, which Tim is now dutifully promoting, I'll try and unpack a bit more, perhaps from a slightly more academic position, this question of who's speaking for whom. But in this short discussion, I think I'll relate to many of the themes that have been addressed by Salim and Andrew, respectively. But being an academic, the first thing to do, I guess, is define what we mean by civil society in this context, because I think it does bear strongly on the types of challenge that we face in terms of representation and the questions of legitimacy that arise in this debate about who is entitled to speak for whom. Because some definitions, as most of you probably know, are very broad about what we mean by civil society. I think in this discussion we'll probably focus very much on organised NGOs, but we could equally talk about the social movements more broadly, organised business groups, which have been very vocal and active in this debate, or the scientific bodies, which have also played a crucial role. Each of which is playing a different role as a different interest group advocating a different interest. But I think the question of legitimacy and who has the right to speak for whom presents itself more vividly when we're talking about groups that claim to speak on behalf of poorer groups, those most affected by climate change. Occasionally, environmental groups will talk about defending the rights of future generations, or even more generally still, the environment. Essentially, those without a direct voice in the climate change debate, or those that are underrepresented in the way in which the policy debate is currently framed. And it's those groups, of course, that are attracting more scrutiny about who they speak on behalf of. But what I want to argue, essentially, is that it's very difficult for any group to represent anyone effectively in the climate change debate. And this is partly a reflection of the nature of the international negotiations on climate change as they're currently constituted. Salim mentioned before that the costs of attending these negotiations, which take place every year, but there's also a series of interim meetings of different committees associated with the process, is astronomical. It's prohibitive for most elements of civil society. So those groups that are actually taking part in the process and trying to influence it in a direct way represent a very small part of global civil society, if you like. There's also an issue with the way the process is organised internationally, in that NGOs are forced to form common coalition positions. So industry, often under the International Chamber of Commerce and Industry, speaks on behalf of global industry, as if that was possible. Likewise, a group like the Climate Action Network has to speak on behalf of global civil society. So the differences of strategy, of priority, and so on are pressed into these common platforms that groups have to advocate. And of course, only those groups that can afford to attend the meetings and are present are able to speak on behalf of this global constituency. Beyond that, there's also the fact that the negotiations are often conducted in a very legal, scientific manner, which is also exclusionary to many groups that aren't specialised in those particular areas. So these are barriers for effective civil society participation, and as Salim mentioned, they're also barriers to the participation of the majority of the world's countries effectively in these negotiations. And the problem, it seems to me, is that though people are aware of this challenge, and we've now constructed elaborate mechanisms of participation at the international level, there's a danger that they often reproduce the inequalities within civil society at the international level, partly because of the mechanisms I've talked about. And you hear that, I've heard this phrase used by diplomats and negotiators, that the more powerful NGOs that have a voice within their own government and at national level then get to have a second, so they call this two bites at the apple, they have a second chance to make their voice heard internationally because they have the resources, the networks to do so. And so there's, as I say, just opening up new mechanisms of participation so that more groups can be involved in this debate does not necessarily mean we're broadening voice, that we're bringing new stakeholders into the process. But there's also here a strategic dilemma for civil society groups themselves, it seems to me, because they have to be fairly autonomous. They have to be able to react, to intervene effectively. But at the same time, they're under pressure to refer back to their constituents, to their supporters, who should be consulted about the priorities, about what climate change means for them, what their campaigning priorities should be. But there's a tension there between being accountable, inclusive, and being effective and autonomous. And this is something I'll perhaps come back to. On one level, you could say the NGOs that are most active on the climate change debate have to be responsive to their members' concerns and to the constituencies they claim to speak on behalf of. Because if people don't like what they're doing, they can leave those organisations. In this sense, they vote with their feet or with their wallets, if you like. They'll only support those groups that they, whose agenda they support and whose views on climate change they share. So that, there's the sort of direct democracy element to it, but there's also a delegative democracy element in that people know enough what the NGO stands for, what positions it's advocating, and they're happy by joining a group to delegate the right to speak to that group. But there's a more fundamental issue here, it seems to me, which is how can any civil society group be truly democratic or representative in this sense? Should we expect them to be? As I say, people often join groups not because they want representation through those groups, but because they share a common cause with particular NGOs and the ways they go about trying to pursue that cause. And it seems to me the more fundamental role for most groups active on climate change is to try and hold to account those political authorities that do have the democratic obligation, the mandate, if you like, to act effectively on climate change. And of course, that remains governments. And the challenge, therefore, is to democratise the debate as it currently stands. And my concern slightly is that it's still heavily driven by the science. It's a very technical debate. It's not easily accessible to the broader public. And to shift it to a debate about rights and responsibilities, which it seems to me is actually at the heart of the discussion about climate change. And I think we see this in the context of the UK debate at the moment, that we're trying to have a discussion about how to close the energy gap, as Malcolm Wicks has called it. And of course, the UK government seems fairly committed towards nuclear energy in that regard. So they've set up this scenario where we have this enormous growing demand for energy, and therefore the only way that demand can be filled conveniently is nuclear energy. But we need a far more serious debate about energy futures, different types of energy future, and the risks and the benefits that might be associated with those, in which people can effectively participate. Because it is a debate, a sort of public debate about risk, effectively. How much climate change are we willing to risk? What responsibilities do we undertake as a society to reduce that risk? So this is what I mean by trying to democratise the debate. And in many ways, you could say people participate in this debate very directly. They don't always have to do it through civil society organisations that try and speak on their behalf. We do it all the time, routinely, through the market, through our day-to-day decision-making about transport, which transport systems we use, about how we heat our homes. All of these things are day-to-day decisions which allow us to express our voice on climate change, if you like. Also through the market, should we choose to, we can engage in consumer boycotts. And some years ago, there was the boycott of Esso, or Exxon in the US, for their strong opposition to the Kyoto Protocol and large-scale funding of the Republican Party in the US. So there's been that sort of using the market to register your vote, if you like, through boycotts, but also through positive, if you like, ethical consumerism, purchasing things which are more energy efficient or fuel efficient, etc. So there are various ways in which individually we can register our vote as climate activists, if you like. And this is one of the key challenges, it seems to me, for civil society groups working on climate change, is that the nature of the issue, that the sources of greenhouse gases are so diverse, so disaggregated, it presents a huge challenge of coordination between groups. And to try and target the different key target groups here, consumers, industry, government, etc., on all fronts and at all levels, presents an enormous challenge of strategy and coordination. And the extent to which this challenge of representation represents itself, it seems to me, depends on the strategies that the groups adopt. For example, we've seen an interesting rise in attempts to use the law to try and hold governments and businesses to account for their climate impacts. And there's a case currently before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights that's being brought by Inuit communities that are seeing evidence of their livelihood being undermined by melting ice and other impacts which they associate with climate change. And they're bringing a case against the US government because of that. Likewise, at state level in Germany and other countries, there have been cases against export credit agencies, which are still giving support to fossil fuel intensive infrastructural projects, which they know will have a negative impact on climate change. With legal strategies, sometimes there's an identified group that's going to be impacted on climate change, so it's obvious who's being represented. Other groups are choosing to engage more closely with business. The climate group that Mark represents, who was meant to be speaking tonight, are working very closely with business and government to try and show what can be achieved by tackling climate change, by reducing energy inefficiencies and therefore saving enormous amounts of money. Other groups are working much more closely with government and are very active at the international level. And the concern here is that those groups which are most influential nationally and internationally at the moment are those which represent the smallest popular base, if you like. They're very effective at doing that, but there are concerns perhaps about who they represent. In the US, for example, the Big Ten, as they're sometimes called, Natural Resources Defense Council, Environmental Defense, etc., very active on this debate, very influential, but actually represent very small numbers of people. Some of the lawyers that have been very effective in this debate field and others, again, these are effective organizations, but they're not mass membership organizations. So there's a tension there that those voices within civil society that are being heard, that are the most effective, are the least representative, if you like. But the broader challenge then is how civil society groups, how the NGOs most active on this, broaden their constituencies, deepen their roots within civil society. One way, Andrew's already talked about this, is this coalition building, the climate and development group you talked about, the linkages that were long overdue between development groups and environmental groups are an interesting development in that regard. But there's also challenges in terms of intra-civil society representation. So where you do have these global coalitions, such as the Climate Action Network, there are challenges about how you meaningfully make decisions, set priorities, strategize when you have 365 plus members. And I think there has been a shift beyond the days of some of the insensitivity that Andrew was talking about from the early 90s onwards, where environmental groups were not talking to development groups, or northern-based groups were tending to speak on behalf of other groups, and there's been numerous conflicts around that. But I think things have moved on from there. But it doesn't get round some of the structural inequalities in terms of access and resources within those networks and in terms of trying to represent themselves at the international level. So in conclusion, a couple of minutes left.
Yeah.
I think the interesting thing about climate change is that it highlights some more fundamental inequities and democratic deficits within the economic and political system. Because as things currently stand, those countries and actors that are polluting most are currently refusing to accept responsibility for their actions. And of course, I'm thinking of the US and others, but you could equally apply this case to industry. Those that suffer most from climate change, many of the actors that Salim was talking about, have the least voice in the debate. And groups such as his are trying to address that issue by building capacity to participate more effectively in the debate. At the same time, those who have the most to gain from unsustainable development, from business as usual, if you like, have the most voice. They're very influential, many of the key industries and sectors, and have the ear of government on many of these issues, which amounts to a huge challenge for civil society groups to try and take this debate beyond an elite discussion between business and science and governments, and to try and democratise the debate in new ways by challenging the framing of the debate as one that's just about the science and about technological options. That's also about trying to bring in groups that are currently underrepresented or actually out of the debate altogether, and also in terms of promoting new innovative and radical solutions to the problem.
Right, well, thank you very much, all three speakers. Many themes there. Some of the things I was picking up on is the way in which the debate itself is changing from being a science-based technological assessment to something which is more acknowledging diverse actors in diverse ways. We've got the way in which the NGO movement, civil society, may be accountable or representative in different ways. And we have the underlying dilemma, which is what on earth do we do and how do we influence the important people? So I'm now going to open up the meeting to people who wish to ask questions, and I would especially like to hear from people representing NGOs or other civil society groups. And I think what I'll do is I'll take a couple of questions first. I will give you the choice as to whether you also want to introduce yourself. You don't have to do that, but if you want to say who you are and where you're from, I would love it if you do that as well. So, questions. Let's see now. We'll have this chap here, and then that person there. So, yes, we'll start with... thank you very much. Yes. Two questions, and then we'll take another two.
This discussion is about who is speaking for whom. I would suggest that the House of Lords Select Committee, which is presumably set up by Labour but was all party, was speaking for people in general. And it's important to realise something of what they said. We have some concerns about the objectivity of the IPCC process, with some of its emission scenarios and summary documentation apparently influenced by political considerations. There are significant doubts about some aspects of the IPCC's emission scenario exercise, in particular the high emission scenarios. The government should press the IPCC to change their approach. So I think it may be wrong to assume, as I think all three speakers have, that it's definitely the case that there is a major problem of global warming, and also wrong, even if that is the case, to assume that it's from carbon emissions.
Right. Well, that's an extremely important question, and I think I'm going to ask Salim to answer that in a moment, but I'm also going to ask another question first. Thank you.
There's just a question on emissions trading. Is it a good idea, a bad idea, an irrelevance, or a way of attracting the United States government to the table?
Right. Speakers, you may respond or you may not respond if you choose, but I think Salim should have a go at the first one.
Well, the IPCC was set up under the aegis of the United Nations, as I said, as an intergovernmental body. So the composition of the IPCC are all the governments, and they actually sign off the final reports of the IPCC. The scientists prepare their findings and they bring it to the IPCC, and they have a line-by-line veto from governments. So the IPCC report is actually the report of the scientific, of the governments, finally. And an interesting development that occurred after the George Bush became president of the U.S., he asked the U.S. National Academy of Sciences to look at the IPCC report, which had just come out, the third assessment report, and with the expectation that the U.S. scientists would find flaws in it and challenge it. The U.S. National Academy of Sciences, within a matter of just weeks, went back to the White House and said they had no real disagreement with the third assessment of the IPCC because they had participated in it. scientists from the National Academy of Sciences were part of the IPCC. They reviewed it, and they had no disagreement with it. So the U.S. Administration, the Bush administration at that point, was not able to challenge the science of climate change. They still don't challenge the science. What they challenged was whether Kyoto was the right way to deal with the problem. So in terms of the science of climate change, the IPCC is the most authoritative view there is. It involves the largest number of scientists from all over the world in coming up with their assessments. That doesn't make it absolutely correct, doesn't make it absolutely with complete foresight as to what's going to happen. They do make their assessments, and many of the scientists who participate in the IPCC, and I have done myself, disagree with parts of the final report because it's built by consensus. The final report is based on consensus. I'd like it to go much farther than it does in many different respects. So disagreement is part of it, but what it does represent is the most authoritative consensus view of the scientific community at any given point in time. And there really is no other similar construct in trying to get scientific views together on issues of global concern as the IPCC is.
Right, well, that's Salim's response. Do any of you wish to respond? Is the IPCC getting it wrong?
Well, I just think the question was quite an interesting example of what we're talking about this evening. I mean, Salim's referred to the fact that, and I think it's probably fair to say that in terms of you never get absolute consensus in the scientific community, you never get absolute certainty in the scientific community, but the IPCC probably represents one of the broadest consensuses that there's ever been on a major environmental issue. And I just think it's quite interesting for a moment to pause and reflect upon the nature and the composition of the IPCC compared with the nature and the composition of the House of Lords, and even going down from there, the composition of a House of Lords committee. I'm fascinated to hear that the House of Lords speaks on behalf of anyone other than a sort of bunch of people with inherited aristocratic titles, senior church membership, and cronies appointed by political parties. So, and I think that particular committee was run by Lord Wakeham, who's got sort of a list as long as your arm of industry associations and et cetera, that you were referring to. So, I think, you know, it's possible to find platforms to leverage contrarian science and business points of view in all kinds of places, and I think they did it very successfully with that particular House of Lords Committee report. But it is important to point out that that House of Lords Committee report flies in the face of pretty much everything else that's come out from pretty much everywhere else over the last few years. And I would just ask you to reflect upon the nature and the composition of the House of Lords just for a few seconds.
Yeah, just to come on this IPCC debate, I mean, actually this claim has been made many, many times that it's a heavily politicised process. Of course it is, inevitably it is, for all the reasons Salim has talked about. And many of the key debates are often over the policymaker's summary, which, to be honest, is what most people read. They don't read the full reports behind it, which go into the detail on science and the socioeconomic costs. I guess the question is, people can always turn back to the IPCC and say, or to the scientific community generally, and say, we need more evidence before we can act. There's potentially high economic costs involved in acting and in not acting, and we need more science before we can act. This has routinely been a strategy of the US and other delegations that are keen not to move progress forward by just calling for more science. The question is, are you asking science to resolve a political question? And it seems to me that's what's going on here. At some point, you have to make a decision about when you know enough to start acting. And there's many good reasons to start acting on climate change, irrespective of the science, if the political will was there. So it seems to me just keep asking for more science or claiming that it's too political to act upon is naive, and it's often a stalling strategy.
I think this is something we could discuss a lot more, and if anybody wants to refer to this later on, please do. But we also had the other question, which is, if I can summarise it quickly, emissions trading, what is it, and is it a good idea, and does it let the US off the hook? Is that your question? Yes, I thought so. Anyone like to respond to that? Andrew first.
Yeah, I would, because I think this is an enormously important question, because an awful lot of energy, and political energy, negotiating energy has gone into creating markets for trading carbon. And I think, as with all trading issues, what matters is how you construct the market and the nature of the market. It's a very effective way of trying to begin the long, slow haul of internalizing traditional externalities within the economic equation. That is very, very important. But there are major equity issues. And when I say equity, I'm not talking about stocks and shares. And I think the danger is that if you put all your faith into the construction of sub-global emissions trading markets, you end up, in a funny sort of way, dealing in stolen goods, because you have you have chosen for yourself that you have the right to emit a certain amount into what is a global commons without real recourse to the other global stakeholders. And I think if you're going to go through a process of capping emissions and trading, you have to deal with the bit in the middle, which is how you allocate entitlements to trade. And that has to be a global process. And there is the danger that the more you delay the proper evolution of a global market built upon the fundamentals of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which has equity written into its heart, that if you do that for too long a period at a sub-global level, you end up doing the developing world out of its entitlement to emit a fair share and to benefit from the economic advantages that come through those emissions. So carbon trading is just a tool. It's an economic instrument. What matters is the shape of the marketplace within which you are trading. Now, to my mind, that has to be a global one at which you politically agree, based on the best available scientific evidence, how to cap emissions at a safe level. And then you have to have a formula for allocating the emissions and hitting certain reduction timetables. And there is a framework called contraction and convergence that deals with how you will politically negotiate how much you're going to shrink global emissions and the rate of time over which you converge to giving people equal per capita entitlements.
Right. Do you want to add to that? I mean, I could say a few words, actually. For many people here who may not know the emissions trading scheme, it's one of the ways in which countries can achieve targets of reducing greenhouse gas reductions. And emissions trading means that if you have overachieved your production of greenhouse gases, you can buy credits from a country which has underproduced greenhouse gases. The basic problem with the system is what a lot of people call the hot air problem, which is when you get targets for reductions which are too slack. And the basic problem was, when Kyoto was agreed, Russia and Ukraine were given Kyoto targets of 0% over 1990 levels at a time when, because of deindustrialization, they were something like 30% below their targets. And resulting problem is what we call the hot air problem, because Russia can sell lots and lots of its credits because it's 30% below its target, but none of those credits are anything to do with its own efforts to reduce climate change. It's all simply the result of deindustrialization and too lax targets. Now, a lot of people criticize emissions trading because they think, oh, it's just another way to America can buy its achievements from other countries. And to a certain extent, we can see that. However, I don't think necessarily that America is necessarily to blame or can be blamed because of emissions trading. I think it was just one strategy amongst many to try and get the American signature on the Kyoto Protocol to begin with. And if it can work effectively, it can be a step in the right direction. But as Andrew has already said, it's partly down to the allocation of who gets what. And as things stand at the moment, that isn't particularly well done. Okay, I'm going to move on to other questions. We had one up there, if you'd please. We'll come to you in a moment, sir, but we'll take two from upstairs. Thank you.
Linda Corsha from the Geography Department here. I'm looking at the panel and probably LSE generally, and the heavyweights in NGOs, the heavyweight decision makers, and looking at parliaments, and certainly looking at Bangladesh as a whole, and looking at business, and looking at the model that the orthodox economics is predicated on of rational economic man, and the corporate image of Davos Man, looking at who is speaking for whom, there's a pretty big issue there of that it's all male-dominated voices speaking for everyone. And as we're looking at the absolute most fundamental gut problem of survival, maybe there is a relationship between those.
We'll take the other question and then we'll answer them both. Thank you.
I'm interested in why Russia ratified the Kyoto Protocol, and you've just referred to the hot air issue. And I wondered who Putin was speaking for, whether it was for economic interests, political or environmental, possibly, interests of Russia.
Thank you very much. So two questions. The first one was, if I can paraphrase your question, you were asking, I suppose it's a gender, radical gender question, is the environmental problem of climate change reflective of patriarchy, male bias in economic exploitation? And you're also drawing a parallel with this panel as well. Anybody like to answer that one?
No disagreement.
Well, I think you're probably right. I think there is a link between the male domination and the nature of the problem. But short of a little bit of kind of retrofitting genetic modification, I can't do much about that for myself. But I think you're right. Yeah, I think there is a problem. We try to do our best to make sure that, at least in our own organisation, that we're pretty balanced and et cetera. Oh, and Russia as well. I think the quick answer to the Russia question is that... The difficult choice facing Mr. Putin was whether Russia was going to do very well out of joining the Kyoto Protocol or whether it was going to do very, very well. And they basically, with a little bit of arm twisting, decided to sign up when they were going to do very well.
Just to take up this question of whether there's a male bias in this process, probably, I mean, almost certainly across the board that's the case, but I would just say, more anecdotally, in terms of representation of women within NGOs and business that are involved in this debate, I mean, a number of the key NGO activists that I know of are women and have been involved in these debates for, you know, a number of years. And it seems to me women's groups are getting more and more involved in this debate as the poverty dimension becomes more relevant and as some of the discussions around climate impacts intensify and it becomes obvious that poorer women are often the victims in this of climate change. So there is that level of mobilisation which seems to be increasing. But even at the elite level at which much of the debate takes place, it seems to me women actually are fairly well represented, even if you might argue that the structure within which they're operating has a male bias.
You're happy with that? I mean, the only thing I can say, I'm not a panel member, but I am the chair. I'll just say that I understand that a couple of women were approached to be on this panel, but unfortunately they couldn't make it. It's just one of those things which happens. But I thank you for your question. More questions? You had one down here, didn't we?
Bangladesh has been mentioned. So when we're talking about the need for dealing with the situations for Bangladesh and other countries which are industrialising, what do you feel should be done to help that they do so in using the least carbon-emitting forms of energy? Don't you think it's incumbent as part of any kind of international arrangements that those with the technology make sure that they provide ways and means of alternative energy or of the most effective in terms of the least polluting forms of carbon production possible? And the other side is with regard to the hoary question of whether or not we can sufficiently quickly convert to alternative energy forms around the world to deal with the shortfall if we're going to be giving up on gas and oil, etc., etc. What, of course, do the panel feel about this? And in the short term, do you have any specialist knowledge on whether or not the talk of being able to capture CO2 emissions and pump it into pipes underground or under the sea is okay, and that therefore this would mean that we could allow carbon emissions, provided that they are captured, so that we could have electricity produced by coal, etc., provided it's done in this way. Is that is that technically possible? Is it acceptable?
So that's a complex question about technology, industrialization, and energy. We'll just take that question here, and then we'll try and answer them both.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jovin. I'm from the International Business Leaders Forum. My question is about the lack of implementation of all the strategies on climate change. And I'm wondering, despite the body of knowledge that we have on climate change, and despite the talk that we are having this evening, how many of us will not resist the temptation next summer to take that budget flight to go and visit our friends in nearby countries in Europe? And now we have this booming industry of budget airlines in Asia, and this is very frightening. How probably selfish of us, despite the fact that we've watched this big hit movie of The Day After Tomorrow on climate change, and we know how the politicians reacted, probably we will have the same scenario again. And despite the fact that James Lovelock, who talked about Gaia hypothesis, said it's probably too late to do anything, that we have even to look for homes for environmental refugees. So I would like to ask the panel speakers, is it because of our own nature, human nature, that we are selfish, that we are inevitably going to have a future that's gloomy and doomy? Thanks.
Okay, so two broad questions there. Why don't we just start with the first one? Who wants to go first? Maybe.
Very happy to. I think that our long and complex question about technology transfer is an interesting one, and it throws up all sorts of dynamics around what makes for successful development, but also where the burden of responsibility for action lies. Certainly, to begin with, there's lots of perverse incentives to do things the wrong way. Up until the late 1990s, just a rough estimate amongst OECD countries was that we were subsidising our fossil fuel industries to the tune of around about $73 billion a year. And putting that into context, that compares with the 0.4 billion that all the aid-giving countries have promised to all the developing countries to help adapt to climate change. So there's certainly some very bizarre priorities in terms of how we allocate resources at the moment. From one small technical thing about what makes for good development, it seemed that one of the sort of the insinuation in your question was that if we've got good renewable energy technology sort of going on in the rich world, we should take a lot of it to the developing world very quickly. But actually, I think it would be far better if people developed their own renewable technologies in developing countries, because they have the technology, they have very often the skills, but sometimes lack the financial resources to multiply and roll out those technologies on any large scale. So good development usually means doing things in country and in region, and sometimes in community, because that tends to build capacity. I think that would be extremely useful. You asked the question about carbon capture. Well, one of the things which often gets kind of glossed over about carbon capture is that it actually takes quite a lot of energy to capture carbon as well. So it's not a simple and straightforward business, and the science of carbon capture is not well tested yet. And there is also, I suppose, the psychological worry that if you think you can do carbon capture, then you can get away with not having to cut your emissions. And I actually think that the scale of emissions cuts that we need are so large anyway that it would only ever have a minimal role to play, although it may have a role to play. Should I do the second question at the same time? The second question at the same time about human nature. Well, human nature is a marvelously malleable thing. I think nothing is set. I think we are, all of us, a mixture of the angel and the beast. And I think depending upon context and in incentive and peer group pressure or peer group example and the rest of it, we are capable of acts of fabulous altruism, generosity, and beauty, as well as being capable of acts of appalling selfishness. My favourite bit in the film The Day After Tomorrow, which of course is ludicrous in many respects, but interesting in others. My favourite bit in the film The Day After Tomorrow reminds me of why I got into working on climate change in the first place, because I spent a long time working for overseas development organisations like Oxfam and Christian Aid, and just to raise the issue of climate change, we did so in the context of the Jubilee 2000 debt relief campaign, when it sort of suddenly struck me that it was rather absurd that we were asking a lot of very poor countries to do some very, very difficult and harmful things domestically to pay off financial debts, which were usually struck up between elites and very often fundamentally illegitimate anyway. And if you just changed the natural resource accounting and looked at natural resources, that the ecological debts of rich countries to poor countries vastly outweighed those of poor countries to rich countries. And the moment in The Day After Tomorrow, which I enjoyed enormously, was when the massed sort of ranks of the North American US population gathered on the Mexican border seeking refugee status. And Mexico only let them in if the US would write off all the third world's debt first, which they did. I thought that was fun.
Do you want to answer about the industrialization or the human nature?
Sure, yeah, I could pick up on a couple of those points. Yes, the whole thing about transferring technologies to enable less developed countries to somehow leapfrog to a higher stage of development and thereby avoid some of the mistakes that have been made in Europe and North America and elsewhere. I mean, clearly there's something to be said for that. My slight concern is about which technologies are being transferred and for whom. Particularly as President Bush said in his State of Union address the other day that he's now developed, he claims, a zero-emission coal. Which strikes me as a bit of an oxymoron. So, and there is a big push towards export of clean coal technology as part of a climate solution, and it doesn't strike me that it's anything of the sort. On alternative energy and its potential, it seems to me alternative energies at this stage, renewable energies, I assume you mean, are unlikely to meet current or future projected levels of demand. So it does seem to me there's a big battle on reducing demand for energy in the first place. This is where some of the battle has to take place. The point about humans being intrinsically selfish, I mean, Andrew touched upon this. I think it's really about creating the right incentives, the right carrots and sticks for all of us to behave in environmentally responsible ways, but without assuming that we're all rational economic men.
Just two quick observations. I think with respect to the larger long-term issue of technology and how we move from a fossil fuel-dominated energy world, it is going to be a change from fossil fuels into something else. What that something else is, we don't know. And the time scale is going to be in the decades, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Again, we don't know that. In the shorter time horizon, many things can be done, including renewables, including cleaner fossil fuels, and there's a lot of technology already available that is being deployed. Some of the developing countries are deploying some of these fastest. Wind energy in India, for instance, is one of the fastest developing energy sources in India. And they will continue to do this. With respect to whether or not human nature is selfish or not, I think this is highly subjective as well. In the end, one has to be either optimistic that we will be able to see ourselves out of this problem, or pessimistic and say that it's not going to happen, so it really doesn't matter. And it's a decision that each individual is going to have to make on the basis of their own views of what is the best way forward.
Thank you. We'll take some more questions. I must admit, the debate about budget flights always seems to be interesting, but it seems to be pointing the finger at various people, saying, you're guilt-tripping you're flying to wherever on a budget flight. You know, there are many other fingers that can be pointed at other people as well. The things which are, you know, big factories, the higher intensity energy users, all these things can also have their fingers pointed at them. Now, I was going to take a question there at the back and a question there at that back as well. So, thank you.
Hi, just wanted to introduce myself as a bit of a conflicted capitalist. Just in support quickly before I go into my point about the budget airlines, one of the most interesting ideas and pieces of scientific evidence I'd heard is that the vapor trails left by airplanes are one of the single greatest contributors to some form of global warming, but not necessarily from carbon emissions, but just generally from particles and cloud particles. But aside from that, the point that I wanted to mention was to return in a way to some of these broad concepts, and especially about civil society and democratic deficit, which I think is one of the most fundamental problems that we're facing in many different arenas, not just climate change, but you know, on a more wider economic and political scale as well. And that essentially that the bodies that represent the interests of, let's say, the emitters are united by a common, let's say, profit motive. And that the civil society is far too fragmented, in my view, to really represent a competing voice. And I think essentially my point is that the solution to this problem will come from the market. Needs to be essentially a capitalist solution that will come from a market base. And that's why I'm in some senses heartened to see carbon emissions as a step towards that in some ways. And I'd just like to ask the panel what their perceptions on market-based solutions are, what is being done, and what could be done to further that.
Thank you for that. The scope for market-based solutions, and another question from here, please.
On our central theme of civil society and climate change...
Can we hear this?
I would like to hear the panel tell us quite a bit more, if we've got time, about states, countries, between the poorest, which we've heard quite a lot tonight, and the richest. Countries like India and China, which we all know are developing fast in capitalist ways, still have problems with poverty and so on. But what about their civil society? Obviously, those two countries are contrasted with one another in the degree to which there is true civil society of an independent nature. But I know, and probably lots of us know, that there are contacts at a scientific level. Civil society can cross national and state boundaries when science is involved, and possibly in other areas too, cultural and other parts of life. I'd just like to know whether there's something important to say about civil society, either transnational or national, in countries which are, in virtue of their size and the speed of their development, extremely important. The poor countries may be small and powerless, but in size they haven't got much impact.
Okay, so that question was, what about the larger and richer developing countries such as India and China, and especially the role of civil society in speaking to them, or them speaking to global civil society? But the other question was, what is the role for market-friendly solutions? Do you want to go first?
I'll take the civil society question in the large developing countries first. I think it's quite varied. If you take, for instance, three of the largest developing countries, particularly important with respect to future emissions, namely China, India, and Brazil, the civil society in each of them plays out very differently. In Brazil, for instance, there's a very large and very thriving climate change civil society coalition that has been involved in awareness raising around climate change issues, in engaging with the Brazilian government, and in fact, in a number of international negotiations, the government of Brazil has incorporated large numbers of civil society participants into the official government delegation, in the Brazilian delegation, to bolster their own numbers and act as resources for the government. So there's a very thriving relationship between civil society and government in Brazil on the issue of climate change. In India, I would say less so, although in India there is a thriving civil society. My own take on the level of their engagement with the climate change issue is quite low. It doesn't really figure as a priority issue when compared to a lot of the other things that they have to deal with respect to development in general and other priorities and crises that the country is facing, and various parts of the country are facing. But it is an issue that is growing in importance. More and more organizations, NGOs are engaging with it, academics are engaging with it, and as time goes by, I think it will go up the level of policy attention, both in civil society as well as in government. In China, it's very much more difficult. As you all are aware, there isn't a great deal of civil society NGO activity, but there are important elements of academia The Chinese Academy of Sciences, for instance, have been quite influential in looking at the impacts of climate change, for instance, in China, and thus engaging with Chinese government policy, which is to recognize that their energy needs and their use of fossil fuels, particularly coal, is going to be part of the problem. But they want to be part of the solution as well, and they are looking for technologies and ways in which they can do that. In fact, China has one of the most ambitious renewable energy targets of any country, including the most developed countries, that they have put in place for the next 10, 20 years. So it plays out in different ways in different countries, but on the whole, I think there is a growing engagement both within government policymaking as well as civil society in all these countries.
Thank you. Anyone else?
On the market solutions question, first of all, it seems to me people are often tempted to say we can do away with these slow, bureaucratic, intergovernmental processes because the urgency of the climate crisis, if you like, requires us to do something else, to look to other actors to take the lead. And business actors, in some cases, have been taking the lead. But my concern about market mechanisms is that they still do require the baseline, the target, the regulations. When we're talking about permit trading, there has to be agreement on how those permits are allocated and reallocated and etc. So market solutions, yes, but it still doesn't do away with the need for the difficult problems we're talking about, and we still have to address these fundamental questions of equity that Andrew raised before. In relation to civil societies in newly industrializing countries, I think, yes, that in China, obviously, there's less democratic space. It's harder for groups to play an active role. But they have done on other issues. We were doing some work on biotechnology a couple of years ago in China. It was surprising that Greenpeace and others have managed to form alliances with parts of the environmental ministry there. They've had media interest. They've managed to change public awareness and shift policy debates on some issues. So it's feasible that in the future the same could happen on climate change. In India, perhaps less evidence of sort of mass mobilizations around this, although when the COP summit was there, there was a lot of active engagement from groups around the climate justice banner. So this was a range of poorer groups that were trying to draw attention to the impacts of climate change on their livelihoods. And I think insofar as connections become more apparent between climate change and health and agriculture and the more sort of, you know, day-to-day development concerns, then we can expect rising levels of interest and engagement. And at an elite level, groups such as Terry and the Centre for Science and Environment and so on have been very involved in the debate for many, many years now.
Very briefly, it is the classic paradox that in order for markets to work, they have to be clearly, transparently and well regulated. And I think if you left it to the market, or left it to the markets in the sense that the question implied, something would happen, some things would happen, but there would be no guarantee whatsoever that you would have adequate emissions reductions in the time frame in which they needed to occur. And what is interesting is I think there's a lot of voices coming from industry at the moment actually asking for level playing fields, for clear and transparent regulation, so they know what they're going to have to do, so they don't have to second guess their competitors and what they might be doing on the issue. So, and I think if you kind of in that kind of marvelously sort of anarchic sense, if you left things to the markets, the market imperfections, which over centuries we don't seem to have been able to get rid of, i.e. having enough information in the price signal. Price signals are usually very bad at knowing, for example, when a fish population hits a critical threshold and can't regenerate itself, when a forest gets so depleted that it can't regenerate. The price signal in the carbon markets at the moment hasn't got a clue when we might hit irreversible runaway climate change. So there needs to be lots of other things working at the same time to give us a hope of getting to the destination we want to get to. I've not really much more to say about the other question, other than the fact that it is quite interesting when you are in a developing country talking about the climate change issue, how it seems to shake off that image that it has in this country as being a luxury middle-class pursuit, because the people who were the driving force, literally and metaphorically, behind organising the Climate Justice Festival in New Delhi, when the Conference of the Parties was there, were the Rickshaw Workers Union. So that gives me enormous hope, actually, that there is the potential for large popular bases of support for radical change.
Okay, thank you very much. We'll be running out of time, so I'm going to take questions. I'm going to take you and you, and then we'll move on. But I hope you can make your questions brief so we can have another round, yes? Thank you. So the woman in the blue and this guy here. You can go first, but then on to you.
I just wanted to focus for a short while on the idea of a global warming tipping point physically, whereby we reach such a stage where we can't reverse what we've already done. A couple of things I've read in the papers fairly recently, the idea of the permafrost in Russia warming up and releasing the carbon into the atmosphere, which can't be reversed, and also something like glacier ice sheets melting, and therefore the sun isn't being reflected as well, so it just increases the process of global warming. I want to ask the panel briefly how close they think we are to a theoretical tipping point where we can't reverse what we've already done.
Thank you. Next one.
Just quickly on the topic of who is speaking for whom, you were talking about an elite discussing this problem all the time. From a scientist in training perspective, how do you suggest that scientists make this topic more accessible to the wider audience without leaving it open to misinterpretation or dismissal?
Thank you. Right. Who wants to go on that one?
Let me take the threshold question first. As I mentioned earlier, the IPCC is coming out with its fourth assessment report, which will be due out next year, and we're expecting that they will be able to speak to this issue quite clearly on the levels of impacts that we can see and when we might be seeing some major catastrophic, globally significant ones. There was a conference organized by the UK government, the Met Office, in Exeter last year as part of the G8 summit preparations, which was looking at the issue of dangerous climate change, which is the word that's used in the UN Framework Convention that we're trying to prevent, and trying to gather evidence on what do we know about danger levels. There were a number of scientific papers presented, which have just come out as a book, incidentally, published very recently, that brought to the attention a number of things that people had not earlier seen. One of them was the acidification of the oceans due to carbon dioxide dissolving in the ocean and being a very mild or acid, in carbonic acid. There's evidence of that growing around the world that it is happening, and a number of marine scientists picked up on that. Looking at the ice melt, particularly the Greenland ice sheet, again, unprecedentedly fast in the last decade of anything they'd seen before. Also in the Arctic, major study in the Arctic region, seeing ice melt there at an unprecedented rate in the last few years. This accumulation of evidence is not, none of it is individually attributable to human-induced climate change, but all of it collectively points in the direction that we may well be on a path that is leading much more rapidly than the earlier estimates of the IPCC had said we would be getting into these major catastrophic events. That's the closest I think we will be able to say it at the moment.
Thank you for that very full answer.
Yeah, just take the point about how scientists can engage with the public. I mean, it strikes me this isn't just a problem of climate change. It relates across the board, many sort of highly technical, specialised areas. We saw this in the GM debate, for example, where many people were saying the public are not sufficiently well-equipped, they're not sufficiently scientifically literate to engage with the complexity of this issue, and therefore it has to be left to the scientists. My point is there is a role for scientific education, for popular education, for producing booklets and materials and videos in schools and universities and elsewhere to try and make people more familiar with some of the basic tenets of the problems and perhaps more importantly what they can do about them. But there's also a need for the scientific community or experts more generally perhaps to be more open to reflection on how they do their work and about how they engage with the public. In terms of allowing, if you frame the issue more broadly about risk and about energy futures, then I think people do have more to say. There is a level of understanding without patronising people and without expecting them to understand the intricacies of climate models. So I think there has to be a shift on both parts. You know, there's a role for public education, but at the same time I think there's a role for reflection and doing things differently on the part of expert communities.
Just a couple of things to add on that. One, which you may well have read about in terms of the early symptoms or signals of potentially rapid climate change, there's the slowing of the North Atlantic Oscillation. For the last 2 years, there has been an uncharacteristic jump in the rate of CO2 accumulation in the atmosphere, which may be a signal of increasing feedback of more rapid release from forest dieback, for example. So there's a number of things kind of ticking away. One of the ones which really scares me, which is believed to be closely correlated with past experiences of very rapid climate change in deep sort of pre-human history, is the release of frozen methane hydrates from the deep sea areas, which can cause very significant climatic changes in a matter of a few years. It's funny, isn't it? I think there may well be a couple of sudden occasions which we might even in our own lifetimes be able to see as particularly dramatic events. But I think the real tragedy of climate change is that it's going to be, if you like, a war of climatic attrition. It's going to be something in which the peaks and troughs of extreme weather events get greater, affecting the people living at the environmental margins and with the weakest coping strategies, and that the intensity will just rise and increase over years. So it'll wear people down, and it won't happen quite like it does in Hollywood, but there will be extreme events that give you that kind of idea. I mean, at the moment, I mean, the real answer is that in terms of triggering runaway irreversible climate change, that nobody really knows, and as each day goes past that we fail to radically reduce our emissions, it's a bit like playing climate roulette. You know, every day we're pressing the trigger, and, you know, every day, well, for some people already, you know, the gun goes off. Most of us, it doesn't, thank God. Scientists can get their act together. They can write plainly. Maybe they could hire good editors, and people might understand what they're talking about. There are a few kind of good examples, but there are also some people who, sometimes it can work the other way. You might get a scientist who's an extremely powerful communicator who may stray from his brief and send confusing signals to our political masters, mentioning no names.
I wonder who you mean. Well, I think it's now 8 o'clock, so we will have to call it a day. I'm just wondering if any of you want to make a final statement? No? Okay. Well, I would very much like to thank Salim Hook, Peter Newell, and Andrew Sims, and I'd like to thank you all for your time and your interest and your questions. This has been an interesting debate about who's speaking for whom. There are clearly issues of representation on the scientific side of things, from the international side of things, from the gender side of things. We've talked a little about all of those, and we shall talk some more. But thank you very much for your time, and I hope to see you all again at the LSE soon.